We are in the middle of the 1700s, and we're talking about the various different things, controversies which raged during the middle of the 1700s. So far we've talked about Hasidim and Snagdim. We've still talked about Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. So tonight I want to talk about the Cleaver Get. Now, the Cleaver Get. The Get of Cleves. Cleves is a town in France or Germany, from the German-Dutch border. Cleves is spelled C-L-E-V-E-S. And the Cleaver Get was one of the great controversies of the 18th century. As in fact, the Day of the Year, during 1766 to 67, a great controversy flared up, which became known as the Cleves Get, one of the clauses to lev of the 18th century. Now, I want you to know, clauses to lev. A clause to lev is like to celebrate the infamous clauses of the 18th century.
Lev?
To lev.
To lev.
Celebrate lev. Oh. Yeah.
To lev. Right? It's like Latin. Oh, okay. That's my quote in English. Okay, I'm glad.
The celebrated incident. It's important to know that, you know, Judaism, basically Reform conservatives, Reform first and later conservatives, came about, fermented towards the end of the 18th century and certainly the beginning of the 19th. And it didn't just happen in a vacuum. The Rabbinic authority was eroded dramatically by the Emancipation, which came, of course, in the wake of Napoleon. But even before that, the rabbis were getting into very big fights. I mean, today's fights, most of them seem tame by comparison to the fights they got back in the 1800s. And clearly, this had an influence on people. People saw that these rabbis couldn't get along with each other, and that's okay, and they're supposed to be holy people. So this obviously created a lot of ill feeling throughout the various different strata of Judaism. And I can't back this up with facts at the moment, but it's my conjecture that all this controversy was what led to the ultimate erosion of rabbinic authority and orthodox authority and the separation from halacha. Yeah.
So this fighting, see, what you're saying is, like, I guess in a way, like, if no one would know about it, and they could have, like, people, each rabbi could have a minion. I mean, would they count the other rabbis or disagreeing with it back then? Would they count that person their minion? Would they hold it not like kosher? They're still obviously a sorel for them, right? Like, they still love the person, just not like what he's saying. No?
No.
Really, just like, I hate that word, Mark.
Whoa.
Okay.
Okay.
Why'd you call it get?
I'm L8 of Bedouin. I'm L85226, August 14th, 1766. Isaac, also known as Isaac, the son of Eliezer Nyberg of Mannheim, married Leah, daughter of Jacob Gunzenhausen of Bonn. On the Sabbath following the wedding, the Sabbath, mind you, the bridegroom took 94 gold crowns of the dowry and disappeared. After an extensive search, he was found 2 days later in the house of a non-Jew in the village of Fahrenheim and brought home. A few days later, Isaac informed his wife's family that he could no longer stay in Germany because of the grave danger which threatened him there, and that he was obliged to emigrate to England. He declared his willingness to give his wife a divorce, in order to prevent her from becoming an aguna, in order that she should not remain married to him when he disappeared. His offer was accepted, and Cleves, on the German-Dutch border, was selected as a place for the guest to be given. Consequently, on the 22nd day of Elul, mind you, they got married on the 8th day of Elul, right? This is the 22nd day of Elul, this is 2 weeks later, right? On the 22nd day of Elul, Israel ben Eliezer Lipschitz, the Av Basin of Cleve, effected divorce. Leah returned to Mannheim, and Isaac proceeded to England. When his father learned of the divorce, he suspected that the whole affair had been contrived by the woman's relatives to extort the dowry money from Isaac. He turned to Reb Tevela Hecht of Mannheim, who invalidated the guest on the ground that, in his view, the husband was not of sound mind when he delivered it. Okay, so basically, it's insanity. A person who's insane cannot give a guest. Which is what defines insanity. The Gemara, it's very difficult to define insanity because insanity is something which happens internally. And therefore, we have to look for signs of it on the outside, which don't necessarily always readily present itself. So what I said, it gives a whole bunch of money of signs that a person is insane. He goes and sleeps at night in the cemetery. When you give him a nut, he throws it away. When you give him a pebble, he takes it. Right? There are all sorts of different tests which you run. But ultimately, it's very hard to pin down somebody who's insane. All of us are somewhat insane.
What about Ted Bundy?
No. What?
Ted Bundy.
Yeah. We're all neurotic, and many of us are psychotic, right? So how we actually go about defining ourselves as insane. Bear in mind, a system psychotic is not necessarily insane in terms of giving a guess, right? We can have severe issues, but nonetheless be competent to divorce his wife. As a story which I heard about Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that there was once a fellow monk, you have to ask Rabbi Braun whether the story is true, because, you know, any story must be about Rabbi Yaakov, but Rabbi Braun will know whether it's true or not. So this fellow in Muncie many years ago, who went around and saying that he was Mashiach. And
how old was this?
Obviously, no later than the early 80s. So so as he was going around for his reporting that he was Mashiach, you know, his wife wanted a divorce from him, but the affair, because he wants to be married
who
to
divorced Mashiach?
He wants to be married to a false Messiah. Anyway, so the problem was that, you know, guy goes around saying he's Mashiach, so then people are going to say he's insane. And if they say he's insane, the get is not going to be the get. So later, the Yaakov went up to the fellow and said to him, listen, I know, you know you're Mashiach, and I know you're Mashiach. But you know, and I know, that the time has not yet come for you to reveal yourself. So let us keep this quiet until the right time comes about. And according to the way the story goes, he stopped publicly asserting he was Mashiach, and therefore the get passed with flying colors. Yeah. Now, this...
That's a lot.
What?
The test a lot.
I don't know, because it's sort of funny, but it's funny that I want it.
Yeah.
What?
Mine's a weird
thing.
Talking
it's
interesting,
like,
oh,
so
yeah.
Same way
the
little truth. The Bible didn't have to give a death, so
it
wasn't a problem. The,
his wife was also crazy.
So this insanity thing, you know, was basically a very big chiddush, because, you know, this is what the insanity here consisted of: severe paranoia, obviously, right? This person was a paranoid person because being persecuted, where his life is in danger, when in all probability nobody could care less about this. Mm-hmm. So that was the assumption. So, you know, yeah, people are paranoid. I'm sure many of us in the yeshiva are paranoid about various different things, and paranoia, hope, is not considered to be true insanity. Otherwise, we'd all be in tremendous trouble. By the way, Shiva Bachman had a tremendous incidence of depression, as you know. Oh, they get depressed very easily.
What?
So therefore, you know, why?
Yeah, true.
What?
I see that even here.
The depression existence, you know, we can never measure up. You're never going to measure up to the, you know, to the Zolan, so you're basically a loser your whole life.
I'm not
sure. Yeah.
I'm a moron before that, so. Okay.
I saw in the Guinness Book of World Records that they did a happiness survey. Did I tell you guys about this? They did a world happiness survey. I haven't looked up online. I'm sure it's not online. But they mentioned the happiest country in the world and the least happiest country in the world. The happiest country in the world, the place where 55% of the population define themselves as being very happy, is
Australia. Amsterdam.
Colombia.
Venezuela. They don't care. They take siestas and they're down in the streets. What do they care? They have lots of money from the oil. So
they're
what? Not Venezuela.
No.
The and the least
55% is the most happy. It's not so happy.
The 55% of the respondents respond that they are very happy. Okay, there's another 90% that are happy. And there's one such world in which only 3% of the population said they were very happy.
America.
Israel.
Papua New Guinea.
Lithuania.
Germany.
Latvia. The Latvians and the Litvaks are really the same people. Isn't that true? I mean, Latvia and Litvak are on the border. Pels is on the border between Latvia and Lithuania.
The Latvians.
So, I bet you Lithuania is in close second place. Anyway, so these stereotypes are all true, you know. When we talk about counter Litvaks and them being morose and depressed, this is true. The surveys have borne that out. The least happy country in the world. Okay. Paranoia, depression, all these things are something with things which affect the Jewish community. So the question is whether this can be regarded as a fact and standing or not. And Rabbi Tevila Hess, the man I just said that it was. Hess, not a lot. Sorry.
Are mitzvahs supposed to lead to simcha?
Not all of it.
But it's not like a necessary implication.
No. But you give your wife a get, it's also a mitzvah.
Right.
Mr. Barringer
or
your
shop. Right. Well, yeah, I don't know if he was going to say that yet. I think there were, he had a presentation. Yeah.
So,
you have that smile on your face, which I don't like.
You're saying that if someone tries Misa to make a psalm or maybe kill someone anyway, he runs off. If you're later, you find him later, he wears a sheep with lots of students, you should feel no pity for him and kill him.
Right.
And he says that if you have any pity for this man at all, you're a sinner.
Okay, Hess, not relying upon his own judgment, applied to the basin of conflict and to Naftali Hirsch, I love his last name, Katzenellenbogen, Eliezer Katzenellenbogen of Hagenau, and Joseph Steinhardt of Fürth, requested their confirmation of his rulings. A basin of Frankfurt headed by Rabbi Avraham Tzvi of Litau not only agreed, but demanded that Lipschitz himself declare the get invalid and proclaim Leah to be still a married woman. So the Beit of Frankfurt took the side of the get being invalid and the insanity issue.
How long was this after the get was issued?
This is all within the first couple of years. Uh-huh. It was...
She hadn't gotten remarried or anything at that time?
No, she hadn't gotten remarried. So the rabbis of Faust, Hagenau, and Fürth, on the other hand, upheld Lipschitz and declared the divorce valid and the woman free to remarry. Both sides appealed to all rabbinical authorities of the time. That was the main, it's like the Judaism speaking, it's not a firm source. It was every rabbi in Europe was involved in this. Probably beyond, America, Asia, everybody. The rabbis please receive the support of almost all the leading scholars of the generation. Among them, Reb Shaul ben Arye Leib Lowenstam of Amsterdam, Reb Yaakov Emden was the big gun, Ezekiel Landau of Prague, that's the Noida Behuda, Isaac Horowitz of Hamburg, that's one of the descendants of the Shlach Kadosh, David of Bethel, Arye of Metz, that's the Shagas Arye, Elchanan of Danzig, that's the Chai Odom, Solomon ben Moses of Chelm, and 10 scholars of the Klaus, the base matters of Brody. The Klaus? Klaus, really, is close. It's pronounced. It's the base matters where people sit and learn all day. It's a play. Klaus was the place where people, what we call today a Klo, they call the Klaus, and also the people sit and learn usually for their entire lives. So, the, the went so far there it was the Rabbanim of Frankfurt put a chelem on the Noida Behuda, like Behuda is one of the great rabbinic authorities of all time, and all of his descendants for all time that they would never be permitted to serve in the rabbinate of Frankfurt am Main.
The
rabbi in Frankfurt was considered a big deal. The Pneo Shul was the rabbi in Frankfurt. There are a lot of great rabbis, the rabbis in Frankfurt. It wasn't the small kahilos and the major kahilos in Europe. So this was, and so it was a good job. So it was a pretty big, pretty thing. What? Yeah, but now it's paid as well. It was a pretty stinging rebuke of the Nerdy Behuda. You know, you say he was probably the God of Adoram Sakalaha, and they're saying, we couldn't care less. Neither you nor any of your descendants until the end of days will serve as rabbi in our community. My style is whether Kahala Dasi Shurin in Washington Heights, which is a direct successor to the Frankfurt Kahila, whether they also abide by this ban and will not take as a role any descendants of the Lady Behuda.
Landau's
a descendant of the Lady Behuda.
How can you do that? But how can you put people who aren't even born into him?
Pretty fair. What's up with fair? They were angry.
How does it make sense? How could somebody is that not beyond their actual capabilities?
The Neidura mortally insulted the Rabbanim of Frankfurt, and therefore he deserves to be punished.
Fine, but where does the punishment for his children come in? Do they have the authority to make this kind of decree of your descendants X, Y, Z? That's what everyone seems to be a little bit upset over.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah?
Yeah, as long as the Kila continues, and there was a Kabbalah in the Kila one time, unless somebody is able to break that Kabbalah somehow, it continues.
So is it descendants or disciples?
Descendants.
They could break it with like a lot of different rabbis, huh? Another do it again, like break that.
They could, but the mitzvah was never broken. I mean, they never rescinded the decree. So it says, although the base of Frankfurt was virtually alone in its opposition, the moving spirit in the deceit was the Frankfurt Dion, Nathan Ben Solomon Mas, on whose initiative the Frankfurt rabbis even went so far as to publicly and with solemn ceremony to commit to flames the response of the Polish rabbis in protest against their intervention in favor of Lipschitz. So it's like burning the Rambam all over again. Those are the times to be alive. Can you imagine people today, even in Suey Kaiser, they're not going to go out and take the books of Rabbi Soloveitchik or Rav Kook and burn them in public. Those are the days when men were men. You know, when people actually did live by the courage of their convictions and went out and did stuff, right? It doesn't grab Anyway, you guys ready for the surprise ending?
Yeah.
They all had
the the couple finally remarried. And out of deference to the opinion of Rabbi Avram of Frankfurt, no blessings were pronounced at the ceremony. Instead, the groom said that with this ring, you are still married to me. I mean, a dying Mekudeshesli, that's a bazook, and that's Moshe of Yisrael. The complete episode of the Priest of Voices is recorded in Ori Yashar, Amsterdam 1769, so by 1769 the whole thing was off, by Alan Simon Copenhagen, who had followed the events and who had himself played a part in the granting of the guest. Israel Lifshitz devoted no less than 37 of his response to the polemic in his Ori Yisrael, which came out in Cleves in 1770. So this the Cleaver guest was one of the watershed events in Jewish history. First of all, it happened. It furthered in many ways the halachic definition of insanity, and it actually tried. There are many poskim from the time who wrote on the issue who are quoted in Rabbi poskim because the definition of insanity is a critical component of this issue. And of course, it comes up in many areas of halacha: who is insane, who is not insane. But besides that, this was an area in halacha in which there was no way to resolve it, since there is no great Sanhedrin or any great rabbinic body would to override all others. Has a couple never gotten remarried, right? This could have smoldered forever and ever. Because there is no way, no tool by which these things can be brought to any close. The basin of Frankfurt was stubborn to the end. They refused to admit that they might possibly be wrong. They refused to admit that the guy might not have been insane. And therefore, in the final analysis, there was no way that anybody else could overcome them. So this became a very, very negative episode, which, you know, they don't tell you about Shuva school about the seventh grade, people will say, because it was kind of nasty. But the Cleaver Get is actually a watershed event in Jewish history of the 1800s. Yeah.
Is there anything in Halakha that we have a record of precedent then for later portion, like you said? At least in American law, due to the way everything's organized, we can look to previous cases when researching a case and making
a decision or arguing. It seems like there's nothing like
that
in Al-Falak
or
a
very
narrow
manuscript.
There's
no central authority to record previous cases down for precedent. Is that correct?
Yeah, but usually what will happen is that there'll be a question. See, it really requires the improving communications of the 18th century to have such a thing happen. Because it used to be before that a shiloh would be local, it was decided by a local rabbi, and then that would go into the literature, and the next time the question would come up, they would go and refer to that local rabbi, right? Who had written 100 years earlier on the topic, or 50 years earlier. And generally speaking, you can follow a trail through the halachic literature of precedence. You know, the Reuven passed it on in 1570, Shem passed it in 1690, Levi passed it in 1731, and so on and so forth down the line until the present day. And maybe there'll be two or three strands of thought, which then you have to reconcile. But this is the first issue in which, you know, it was just a free-for-all. You know, it's like the bumper cars in the amusement park, right? Yeah. Everybody's steering to everybody else, and there's no way of actually following any rational pattern of what actually is going to be the approach. We suffer from this to this very day. The Cleaver Get mentality, because this very day, especially today, you have rabbi, there's no way you can resolve an issue like, should there be an Erev in Brooklyn? There shouldn't be an Erev in Brooklyn, right?
Depends
who you ask, and everybody will be equally vehement about it, whatever side of the coin they're on, right? Some people will say, it's not because it's not to have an Erev, some people say it's not because it's to have an Erev, and there's no way of ever resolving any of these issues. This is the sad state of halacha in our day and age.
It doesn't seem like any of this could ever be resolved unless there's some nature that everyone unifies, because it just no one will agree on anything. It seems like I think Dostoevsky writes in the Grand Inquisitor, right? It's sort of about I'm not going to get into it because there's some other type of religious undertones, but it seems like if someone came who would save the world, no one would be able to recognize him. in a certain sense, because everyone would be arguing halakhically, oh, well, he's kosher, he's not kosher.
Okay, they're long enough.
I mean, unless God put his head, you have to accept his judgment as an overarching authority, that this will never be resolved. It seems one of the areas within Judaism mm-hmm. that there's very little hope, if any at all.
True.
What the hope of the
so what
the,
I mean, what's that? I mean,
Is
there any way you can see this ever being resolved without some sort of metaphysical event taking place?
No.
So
it would have to happen.
It's short of like clouds parting, a voice coming out from the heavens telling us what to do.
Yeah, it's not 100% true. There were people in recent history in classical who were almost universally accepted or loved. The ones who come to mind are people like Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. There is a book which everybody should read, should be mandatory reading for all from Jews. It's called The Tzaddik in Our Time. Who has read it?
Oh wow,
Rabbi Aryeh Levin.
Write it down.
Did you read it?
We have it in the yeshiva English library.
I know about it.
None of you have read this book?
No. It's in the library.
This is terrible.
What's
this
called?
It's a tragedy.
Kavua does it
shining
either from this or
Krishna.
What?
What's the book?
What's English?
It's also Hebrew if you want to read it in Hebrew.
In Aramaic?
The Rav Aryeh Levin was a very big tzaddik who lived in Yerushalayim and passed away in the 1970s. He was it's called the Yerushalmi tzaddik. He was loved and he loved everybody and was beloved by everybody. He was one of those rare people who transcended all boundaries of Jewish society, from not from right, left, Hasidim, Misnagdim, and was universally loved.
Yeah, but did he play guitar?
You got me there. I didn't know the Sheikh had played guitar. But there are people, seriously speaking, there are people coming around from time to time who are like that. They're very few.
But you
do see it. If you read a book like this, you regain your hope in, you know,
like
in...
Like
what?
Who do you know
is
like this, right?
Why know anybody like this?
Yeah.
Not anybody famous, that's for sure.
No, I'm saying,
no, I don't know anybody.
That
should be like a goal. We should. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was like that. That was Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was sort of like that.
That's why
I think it was
like that.
Yeah.
That's why they had like.
It's very rare.
Even Hasidim, I'm not saying it's the right word, but even like groups who were just held by, Yol Teitelbaum, Rabbi Yol Teitelbaum, like they, the Satmar, they accepted him and the Lubavitcher. Accepted him, everyone accepted him.
They really
had
reverence
for
what
was
it about?
Who?
I love it
too.
Anyone, just saying anyone.
As Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? Yeah.
Wow. What was it about these people?
How did
they
view?
Like, what was their view?
Like, they
offended everybody.
They're very, they excelled at the Mida of Hanover.
It's
Hanover. Hanover.
It's so.
Hanover, yeah.
Shlomo
Zalman, for example, never joined any political party.
Right?
Man, most Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael are affiliated with one political party or another. But Shlomo Zalman never affiliated himself with any political party.
Someone said supposedly someone tried to ask him about something that was kind of political, and he wouldn't answer the question. They said he didn't want to get involved in anything.
Yeah. He was the real thing.
What is rabbis finally in a temple themselves, like majority or most of the rabbis in Jerusalem? And you try to do...
Never.
Why not?
Why?
Why not?
Because none of us get along with anybody else.
There is, could be some universal idea which you unite people. It's a matter of time. Someone would really want it.
I hope somebody gets up, but based on what's going on today, without a dramatic course change, it's not going to happen. The other one I wanted to speak about is the other conference.
What if just majority or whatever, say,
whole Yitzhak, the whole Baja, or whatever, whole Gobo is gonna assemble themselves. And fast for this and that way.
What is that gonna do?
Do they
all the Bubbles can get together and all the Satmas will like this. What do they care?
Usually people listen to their Rebbe.
To their own Rebbe, yeah. But even there, Bubbles, there are two Bubbles now. You know, nobody listens to anybody else.
What is keeping everything a punch? I mean, like, I understand historically people have to rally around their own communities because that was their local law. But today we have phones. You can get a second opinion.
Phones are also a very, very bad thing. Telephones have destroyed Judaism to a large extent.
Wow. Well, you no longer have to, like, rely on your local...
It used to be that the way that lahag system worked is that if you had a psak, somebody would submit to you a question in writing, and you would answer in writing, and it would give the reasons for your psak. Nowadays, when you have a question, you call somebody up, and it gives you very often a yes or no answer, and hangs up the phone, and then you're left on your own without any rationale. And then you, of course, transmit this yes or no answer, you know, it's all over the globe, and we are left with battling rumors. You know, nobody's writing. There's nobody smart writing response to literature anymore. No, there are no new tshuvas coming out.
Sure there are.
Oh, yeah, who?
I mean, Mansour does every single day. He sends out an email. There's a lot of people ask questions. He sends
Who is Rabbi Eli Mansour? He's a Syrian rabbi in Flatbush, right? He's a young fellow, right?
He's very young.
Yeah. He's not one of the post-given of the generation.
Oh, yeah, well, your team is dropping that, so.
But he's one guy that's sending out responses.
He's not sending out responses. He's sending parcel sheets.
Torah anytime is taking over.
Yeah.
You're just jealous you're not on it.
So the big problem is that people don't put out all these different things and people follow it, or has it become like, you didn't ask the Shah to go to watch people follow it, like you give those things by Eliyahu and Ashraf and Shita and Kanievsky, and all these like rabbis, they put out these things, they tell you, it's a type of cell, want to do this type of thing, and people don't follow along at all. Why should they? You know, have you ever seen the Chula thing recorded by Kanievsky, right?
They're not only
one line, they're usually one worders.
Much.
Yeah, Usher, Mutter, Loyal Band.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
I was
just saying that
how is that supposed to deal with that?
People just doesn't have time to, and don't want people to go into confusion because maybe they're going to get some time for office.
Right, but the whole halachic process no longer functions. The halachic process is broken. Yeah, that's right.
But there is people which
don't read email.
Also, there is famous people which known by everyone, which people listen to. Still, there are authorities which not the university accepted, but majority of
that's not good. Why is it good that anybody listens to Rabbi Yossi?
Because at least someone has some kind of power to change or some kind of to lead people to provide direction.
He's not providing direction. Somebody asks a question, he answers the question. Nobody provides direction. In the old days, the good old days, like 20 years ago, before, you know, everything broke down, they had Rabbi Yashiv and Shlomo Zalman, and they have a disagreement. And you could follow wherever you choose to be your Rebbe, whoever you perceive to be correct.
Judaism was
never
a couple hundred years ago. People were normal, people were educated, valued secular education.
No. No.
All the commentators are educated.
You said people. Who do you mean by people?
The layman.
The layman valued secular education, they valued money. My father is a very good yekka. He couldn't care less about secular education. It irks him that we don't have jobs. That's what bothers him, right? You think he cares if we know, you know, the theory of relativity works?
Right.
Just become a lawyer, get a good job, make money.
Right.
That's what it's about.
That's what I mean, really.
It is.
Some sort of secular education.
Yeah. You mean you glorify secular education because it helps you make money?
No, I mean, yeah. People want to make
Is that considered lishma?
Huh?
Is that lishma?
What?
You want to secular space for the purpose of making money?
Not at least,
but not. You have your foot very deep in your mouth. You understand that. I'll let you pick it out if you want.
All right.
Okay. What you really meant to say is that you think that there's a period in Jewish history in which people actually valued secular studies regardless of its capacity of making them money.
Right.
Yeah. How many, which epoch was this?
1500.
Maybe 11th century Spain.
What about Rambam?
The last one. What?
Is the Rambam like that?
Yeah, it's the 11th century Spain, North Africa, that's where it was like that.
Is algebra secular education?
Is algebra what?
Secular education.
What else is it?
You have to plus X. Really geometry
in there. Yeah, but no algebra.
You figure out
the hypotenuse of the square of arba by arba.
That's geometry.
Then you have to figure out the square of everything.
Who here remembers anything from their high school algebra? Wow, that's
calculus.
I remember absolutely nothing.
Wow.
I remember algebra.
You can solve a basic equation.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
But you know,
what does GPL look like? Oh, right. X squared plus 25 plus this, which doesn't work too well.
Apparently, I don't remember any trig and I never took calculus.
What do people do like, I was a finance major. So, there are a lot of things that, you don't need to take, advanced finance courses necessarily. But basic accounting, finance principles, they really come up, a lot. And living, investing for yourself, and stuff like that. What is typical,
No, that's why you have financial advisors.
I guess.
Yeah, but if you have no...
I was just having this discussion...
I was just having this discussion
MTA the other day. We thought about Bitachon, which were my...
What do
Clarion
do, day to day? What do they do? What do they do? They
sell cell phones. What's the problem? They do lots of stuff.
I get it. What do you mean?
They run auction mart. They run monthly outwares. They have cleaners. What exactly is bothering you?
I don't know. I just feel like...
You want everybody to be an accountant?
No, it's really hard to get by
day to day. What does secular education do for you for the most part?
How earth science help me bring food to my table?
Yeah.
You really
a little bit confused here, Michael. With all due respect, Michael, you want people to know how photosynthesis works, right? But nobody's going to get a good job based on knowing about photosynthesis. This is not going to help anybody, right? So you got to sort out these two things here, okay? There's pragmatic knowledge of how to make money, and Jews have that in just as great a measure as anybody else, if not more, right? And then there's knowledge of the secular world or the natural world or history and how these things work, which will not make you any money whatsoever. But you perceive that to be good to possess.
Yeah.
Don't mix up the two. Okay? It's very important. Yes.
How do these arguing rabbis and something kind of make money?
They're all rabbis of Kehillos. They have good community.
Was there a dispute between maybe Paul Tanya and another rabbi about who didn't this Poland should win the war? Of course, at some point
Napoleon, but we're not at that period of history yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. So it's just my note. I was supposed to find out more about the Gaia Tzedek for this week, and I forgot.
Oh,
wow. Somebody should remind me about that for next week.
It's about Napoleonic War.
No, we're not up there yet. But the Gare was the Graf Potofsky. Remember, I forgot to look it up. So can you remind me? On Shabbos, remind me. I'm meeting here Friday night. Remind me.
You're
meeting
Friday.
What?
Night.
Mine's going to be a Friday night.
You also here?
It's the
Smicha. Oh, it's Friday night.
It's the Smicha party.
They're not having a Smicha on Shabbos, are they?
Yeah. I've had it since November. So the paper is like a 5
for all. He did Rabbi Nachman for 6 months.
Ah, right.
Okay. Okay, so the next controversy we got from the Cleaver deck, which I was going to discuss tonight, is the controversy between Rabbi Yonatan and Eibshitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yonatan and Rabbi Yaakov Emden was one of the other ones which ripped apart the Jewish people. Now, one of the greatest experts on the Rabbi Yonatan and Eibshitz Rabbi Yaakov Emden controversy is Professor Schneer Lyman.
Oh, the journal there.
Professor Schneer Lyman is a professor at Brooklyn College, and he is a professor of Jewish history, and he is an extraordinary authority on lots and lots of things, fine Frum fellow, and he is an expert on this, and he knows a lot more than he'll let on to, which is a fascinating thing. But,
how old does Gedolin know with Jewish history?
What?
How old does Gedolin know with Jewish history?
Most of them know pretty well. Yeah, most of them. There's a lot of lore, you know, which gets passed down,
right.
Not just by reading stuff. You know, if you're in the Shiva world, there's a lot of stuff which gets passed down. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's go back to Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, in his system of Kabbalah, introduced several new things. First of all, he really glorified and put a very high emphasis on the Midah of Tiferet. The sphere of Tiferes, which is corresponds to Yaakov Avinu, who was the connected Avram, which was Chesed, on the right, and Yitzchak was Bura, who was judgment on the left. Tiferes is the mixture, the harmonious mixture of them in the middle, which is Yaakov Avinu. And Shabtai Tzvi basically usurped the role of Yaakov Avinu, and he became the Midah of Tiferes. Besides that, however, there was also, he learned that there was God, the UK, okay? And then there's Elokei Yisrael, there's the God of Israel. They're two separate things. In other words, the God is overarching, and God of Israel is kind of like the Shekhinah. It's like the unique divine relationship which God has with the Jewish people. And somehow or another, he links this Elohe Yisrael of his to himself, right? Like he was a representative of the God of Israel on earth, and therefore he was delegated these godly powers in order to save the Jewish people. Now this is an oversimplification, and it's not exact. And besides that, there was a lot of pornography thrown into boot. The Shabtai Tzvi's Chassidim were very much into licentious behavior. And into pornography, meaning that their Kabbalistic system were, the Arizal system of Kabbalah has very heavy sexual overtones to it, or undertones, right? Because it's the Yichudim, the unities of the Divine Presence and Christ, or Divine Presence and Hashem, you know, there are a lot of things which are have sexual allusions to them, and therefore one is not supposed to learn this kind of Kabbalah in depth until one is 40 years old. Why? Because at 40 we assume, once upon a time, I don't think it's true in American society, that people are no longer such big bali taiva. As we see from our presidents and governors and others, this is not necessarily the case anymore. But once upon a time, you know, the average life expectancy was like around 45, by the time you're 40, you're basically done with these things. So that's why the study of Kabbalah was pushed up till that point. The Shabtai Tzvi made it even more sexual to the point of pornography, as I said. If you read Sabbatean Kabbalistic texts, they're all full of all sorts of references to all sorts of sexual activity and how it represents holiness, because it represents unifications and connections, etc., etc. So Well, in one of the popular ways of healing people in the 1700s, this is before modern medicine, was of course by the use of amulets. And in the amulets you would write all sorts of names of angels. You make reference to the spheros. You make reference to all sorts of connections between God and the higher realms, and this person who was sick or needed some sort of salvation, some other sort of way. And one of the most popular amulet writers of the mid-1700s was Jurnius and Eibschitz. Jurnius and Eibschitz was, in his final position, he was the Rav in Hamburg. There are three kehilos which are part of the same umbrella. They're called Ahu, Altuna, Hamburg, and Würzburg might be the third one. I'm not sure that's correct. I think it might be something else. Anyway, so he was a Rav in Hamburg. He wasn't the Rav of all three kehilos. Rav Yaakov Emden saw it to that day. He didn't become the chief rabbi, but he was a Rav who practiced and who wrote amulets and passed and chalice and wrote Sfarim, very basic Sfarim in Halacha and also in Machshava, and he wrote amulets. And Rav Yaakov Emden asserted that some of those amulets were Sabbatean. He can find allusions. Now, I have never actually sat down and tried to figure this, and looked at one of the amulets involved and tried to figure out exactly how the Yaakov Emden saw it to be Sabbatean. But these are the types of things you will look for. If you wrote there saying like Kel Elokei Yisrael, which is a pasuk in Chumash, right? Vayikra Lo Kel Elokei Yisrael, one of the mizbachos in the Midbar was called Kel Elokei Yisrael. So if you had your Sabbatean antenna up, then you'd say, oh, this is a Sabbatean reference, right? Because it mentions God, the God of Israel. There's something funny there, right? You following me?
Yeah,
Shabbat Tzvi made a big deal about this.
Yeah, that's why.
So if you saw an amulet, a piece of parchment.
Well, what connection between this two together and the text or whatever part?
What?
What connection between this phrase, what this phrase relates to the text or whatever?
No, not necessarily in an amulet. In other places, you write about how these things join together and the type of union between the two of them and how they connect. But an amulet...
The Song of Songs by King David also refers many things you could understand differently.
That's true. But it doesn't... you have to have a mixture of things in order to be really... Shabbat Tzvi. You have to have emphasis on certain, not just the relationship between the Jews and Hashem, which Shir Hashim is all about, but all sorts of interrelationships within that, between the figure of Mashiach and between God and other aspects of God and so on and so forth. Okay? I don't know. I'm not an expert in Sabbatean Kabbalah. I'm not even a novice in Sabbatean Kabbalah, so I don't know enough to tell you about it in detail. But there are books written on the topic if you really want to know about it. Anyway, so Rabbi Yaakov Emden saw these amulets and he decided that Rabbi Yonasan Eichitz was a Sabbatean. He was a classical Shabbat Tzvi. So to complicate matters, Rabbi Yonasan Eichitz's son, I forget his name, was a Sabbatean for sure.
Whoa.
Nobody disagrees. He certainly was a Sabbatean. So therefore, that made things even more juicy because he was writing these funny amulets and his son is a known Sabbatean. Who knows what's going on here? So Rabbi Yaakov Emden published, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden also owned a printing press.
Whoa.
Now,
it's like on the television.
Yeah. If you know the under what's his name, the chair, Cesco, the last dictator of Romania. Ceausescu. Under Ceausescu, it was a capital crime to own a photocopying machine. Mm. What about own photocopying machine? Photocopying machines are usually subversive things, right? So to own a printing press certainly gives you lots of freedom to wreak havoc, which would be opposite of the day. It was simply a pamphlet after pamphlet after pamphlet against the Rabbi Yonasan Eichitz. Rabbi Yonasan Eichitz distributed pamphlet after pamphlet, you know, although he couldn't keep up, against Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Now, the funny thing is they both live in the same city. They both live in Hamburg, right? Mm-hmm. And you've got to imagine, this is the locus of this machlokus, which grew to include all of Europe. Because the Rabbi Yehuda actually writes basic Torah, such as the Tumim on Cheshem Mishpat. We have an Emden writes basic Torah, right? The Moruch Tzion Orachai. So these are celebrated rabbis of the time. And everybody starts getting involved. And the Schneer Wyman shows, you know, how people are ambivalent about this. They're not sure what, which way to go with it. For example, when Rabbi Yehuda just passed away, the Nayyid Behuda did not want to be masked in. Nayyid Behuda we spoke about before, Chesco Randau, the one whose kids can't be rabbis in Frankfurt. So he didn't want to give a eulogy because he wasn't so sure about Rabbi Yehuda Abshitz. And he finally was compelled to give a eulogy, and he basically covered things up. He said, you know, he was a great guy. Probably everything was not true. So very, very, very poor, lukewarm hesed. And Schneer Lyman, from this hesed, decides this is the origin of yeshiva's covering up scandals. Because he didn't want to get into it. He tried to avoid it. And he decided to accept the whole issue. So the Gro got involved. The Gro was younger than everybody else. What? Yeah, the Gro allegedly defended the Bjornis and Auschwitz and said that the ambulance were not sabotaged.
There was no doubt as to whether the ambulance had validity in general, just whether they were sabotaged or not.
Right.
So there is a belief that the ambulance have certain power to them.
Absolutely. Right.
That they can heal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Although, again, the Gro, is a true Litvak, I don't think he'd ever write an ambulance. Because although he'd say theoretically they work, who knows exactly how to make them work.
Right? Wow. But I mean, at a time when, I mean, there was a transition over some more Western forms of medicine, and people were using amulets, what sort of swung it one way or another? Is there any
effectiveness?
Effectiveness. So could we say an amulet is more effective than Western medicine? I mean, people.
No, people stop you. You say, how many people know to use amulets nowadays?
No, there is some.
Maybe because there was controversy over it, but I'm saying, I mean, obviously if it worked for, see what I was saying is, if it worked for hundreds of years, then there has to be some validity.
But we don't know it worked. Eventually everybody died. So what does it mean it worked? Define it worked.
That's what I'm saying. It's sort of strange to think if it didn't work, because these are all the people who we have the story from, and if they're all believing in something that's not true, then and we're accepting everything that they said, and there's no good thing that, and they believed in some made-up thing then.
Man, there is medical theory that if I'm going to give you paper to eat and tell you this paper is going to cure you and you're really going to believe you're going to get cured.
It's
temporary.
Right. And nowadays, since most, on the other hand, since most of us are trained not to believe in alternative medicine, so therefore it doesn't work for us. So, you know, even if ambulance once did work, nowadays it would not have the same degree of effectiveness because you really have to believe in it in order for it actually to work. It's self-defeating.
What about when he's also a very colorful person in and of himself? Like, can he do like very interesting things? Like the way he, I don't know. How big wrong with that?
He wasn't a very colorful person. Yaakov Emden was he. I never saw it inside, but he said that Jesus wasn't such a bad guy. He tried. He was, you know, he was a good guy, and he also took, although he was a Kabbalist. He took the position that the Zohar was not to be considered reliable, you know, against many other people.
Where do you get the Kabbalah?
What?
Where do you get the Kabbalah from then?
The place for the Kabbalah besides the Zohar.
What?
Rishonim, Rabbeinu B'chayai. You know, there are lots of places.
Did he get
from the Zohar? Sefer Yetzirah. He could take from the Zohar also, but you know, he didn't regard it as being authoritative.
Okay.
He thought that parts that were forged. Yeah.
Are you on a bloodlet today?
If you believe in it?
Sure.
Yes.
What?
Bloodlust.
We're talking
about
forced
work. Well, yes, anyway, there's an article by Schneer Lyman in which he addresses, there was one of the accusations made for Rabbi Yaakov Emden that Rabbi Yonatan and Eibshitz's wife died. When he put up the Mount Seva, he put up the words, he started every line with a different letter, and it's spelled in a classic Shabtai Tzvi. Now,
by accident?
So, of course, Rabbi Yaakov Emden claimed there was an accident here. And he said he even emphasized the letters. So, Schneer Lyman went to the cemetery in Hamburg and checked out the gravestone. And in fact, the letters are not highlighted. They're not emphasized. But they're there.
Whoa.
So this, that is awful spooky.
That
is awful spooky. So when I saw that, I didn't know what to do with that. I have the article somewhere buried at home in one of my drawers.
Buried.
What?
Who's the grandson?
Who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's it.
What?
That's it. I mean, that's full blown. I mean,
there is a remote chance of a coincidence.
Oh,
but
it's
very...
Yeah,
it's
very... How about the first?
I think it's like this. I think her father's name was Shabtai. And it says three, at the end, beginning of the line, something like that. It's not so simple, you know, but it seems that it was hard for it just to be coincidental. Anyway, the mice, though, even if that's true, you know, Rabbi Yonis and Aishas could have believed in certain aspects of Sabbatean Kabbalah, and nevertheless not have been an Apikores, or a Russia, right? It's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily follow that he accepted parts of it and was therefore a bad person. He might have been mistaken, or he might have been right that certain things Shabbat said were correct, but certainly not the entire package. Kind of like Rabbi Meir learned Torah from Acher, right? Elisha ben Avuya. And we know that he didn't accept the whole package, he just took what was appropriate to take away. In the end, it says that as Rabbi Yaakov Emden was dying, the Yonis and Aishas died first. As Yaakov Emden was dying, the last words he said are supposed to have been, cool legend, even if it's not true, but let's assume it's true, his last words are supposed to have been, Baruch Haba Reb Yonason, meaning that, greetings Reb Yonason, who's coming to accompany him to the world to come. So, you know, this is good because all's well that ends well, right? And they died happily ever after. And in the Hamburg Cemetery, and I forget who passed in this, but something like Nadir, some great person, they're very, very, very close together. They're not directly next to each other, but they're very close together, like one behind the other, something like that. Or it indicates that at the end, we assume that somehow they made peace, if not in this world, then in the world to come. But this obviously had a very negative impact on the world in terms of the attitude towards Kabbalah, the attitude towards Mekubalim, the attitude towards Rabbanim, and the attitude in general towards those things which have been traditional to this point. Which is going to lead us next time we speak to Moses Mendelssohn. Have we spoken about Mendelssohn yet?
No, a little bit.
Okay. We'll expand upon that next time. Mendelssohn, Leah Sushaya Leibowitz. Leah Sushaya Leibowitz. Mendelssohn.